Chapter 28. Lady Estret of Carguenyon. "Here's what we're going to do," I sighed, as I watched my wife wander wearily back to our tent, the warmth of her persuasion still on my lips. She hadn't quite made me promise to ensure Sir Kay's victory on the morrow, but she had offered it as a challenge. Now, it wasn't just my castellan's happiness I had to look to, but my own. I didn't want to disappoint Alia. But I knew I couldn't just help Sir Kay win with magic, either. He would consider it dishonourable, and withdraw from the lists. He was just that way. So I had to abandon sorcery and resort to common skullduggery. I summoned my most trusted associates, Tyndall, Festeran, Bannermore, and my brother-in-law Sagal, who was getting more sleep at the busy fair than he would have been with my colicky new nephew, to the pavilion after the Baron and his party departed, and I'd sent Sir Kay to bed. They all gathered around eagerly, even though they all looked properly tired. A day's fair going can take it out of you, particularly when it involves a scuffle with the censorant, or shopping for a new baby. But they responded to my summons with enough alacrity and enthusiasm to demonstrate their loyalty, both to me and to my castellan. They looked to me for orders, so I gave some. "Festeran, you and Sagal head over to the top contenders' campsite tonight and see what you can learn. Take some silver and a sack of wine, buy some drinks, and ask some questions. Look for weaknesses, fears, things we can exploit. Don't just look at the man. Look at his kit, his organization, what he has for breakfast, everything. Find out who he trusts, who he hates, who he wants to be when he's a big boy. Tyndall and Bannermore, you do the same for number two in the rankings. By dawn, I want to know everything you can tell me about them." They all nodded and went eagerly to work. They liked Sir Kay in their ways, and the idea of skullduggery at this level appealed to the adolescent boy in them. I still had no real idea what to do with the information they would gather yet, but I was reasonably clever. I'd think of something. I was about to go take a nap with my wife and let the wine leave my head when I got the tingle of a familiar mind-to-mind link. "Ah, Penny, what brings you to my attention this lovely summer's evening?"
"It's more of a report. A bad report. I'm sure Tellerman will give you the details in the morning, but I thought I'd give you some advanced warning. Our scouts inside the Shadow say the goblins are force-marching a column south from the Umbra along the Lumber Road, west of Verone. It's a big one."
"How big?"
"At least 8 legions.
That was the rough grouping we used to describe goblin numbers. It corresponded roughly to their own military organization. But for our practical purposes, a legion was 2,000 fighting goblins plus another 500 or 1,000 in support.
And they are not alone. A great number of hobbed eunuchs are marching with them. A few hundred humans are riding as a cavalry screen, probably soulless. But the worst news is the long column of trolls has been spotted too, over 200 strong. That has been confirmed by both scrying and by scouting, and they are armed for siege work.
They only had 50 at Timberwatch," I exclaimed in my own head. "I thought they would have brought their greatest strength there."
"Apparently the Riverlands are a more tempting target than the Wilderlands," she offered.
"But they joined the 5 legions already investing the area, and there are signs that there are further reinforcements preparing." I sighed in despair.
"How long until they reach the Riverlands front?"
3 weeks. 5 weeks if they get slowed down and meet resistance. If they continue down the Lumber Road, they'll spill out directly into Gilmora. Min, I'm no strategist, but the dragons destroyed the better part of the garrisons in Gilmora already. Tellerman is rallying as many as he can further south, at a castle 60 miles north of Barrowbell. But if they come against these others, then they won't be facing stalwart defenders. They'll be walking into a hospital camp. The Horkans are trying to shore up the secondary castles in Gilmora, but there are already advanced raiders moving down into the northern baronies.
Damn them.
Thanks for the warning, Penny. Any idea when the Duke's southern levies will be ready to go?"
"No. I could tell you what I've been told by Count Sargo, which is weeks. But I've also been told that the Banner Call has been resisted in the south, since this is ploughing season. Those reports say at least a month, maybe more."
"It's goblin season," I corrected. This was the problem with trying to raise an effective army in a feudal government. It took ages to pull together your forces, especially in a crisis. Thanks for the warning, Penny. I'll think about what we can do, but unless we can stop that column, Gilmora is going to get pounded. Stopping that column is going to get bloody. I'll speak to Telemann and see what help I can be, but the answer is probably going to disappoint him, I promised. Right now, if you could pass along to everyone that anything they can do to slow down that column and buy us some time has my gratitude and that of the Arcane Orders.
I'll see what I can get set up, but you should definitely speak with Telemann tomorrow. He sounded concerned. He's mentioned that he would like to see you come back to the field, but he's admitted that there's not much you can do right now that other people can't.
But try to check in with him for a dispatch tomorrow. That is, if you can pry yourself away from your bride long enough, she teased. In all sincerity, I'm actually trying to get Sir Kay laid, not myself, I spoke indignantly.
That is a worthy endeavour.
I leave you to carry on, then, she said with a guilty mental giggle, and was gone. Here I was, contemplating seduction and gambling at a fair, while in the west that terrible column of Gavani and assorted abominations was ploughing down Lumber Road, killing everything in their path. It made me feel profoundly guilty, and I drank the rest of the bottle before I sought the solace of my marital chamber. I snuggled extra close to Alia that night, and tried not to dream of goblins. Telemann contacted me early the next morning, before dawn, having spent the night receiving reports and making sense out of them. He had several magi scrying the Penumbra lands and the wilderlands around them, as well as a few tough night magi ranging the enemy's flanks and reporting. The first castle outside the Penumbra that they'd come to, a motte and bailey with a wooden palisade, defended by 300 men, had fallen in hours after the trolls smashed through the walls. Long lines of captives were being herded back north, and the stock was being used to feed the armies as they advanced. Telemann related how a couple of mercenary units and a barony, about 700 lances, had been alerted to the advance, and were planning on making a stand. That would amount to 4,000 or 5,000 troops, against more than twice that number of Gavani, not counting the trolls. He was sending war magi to help coordinate the defence, but he did not sound hopeful. We talked for a while, and I made a few suggestions, but as mighty as we were in magic, we had no good answers, without troops on the ground to give them. Before breakfast, my own spies and scouts reported, although I was less enthusiastic about our schemes than I had been the night before. Sephesteren and Sagal reported first. They split up and infiltrated the camp of Sir Ginselin of Stoves separately, Sagal as a common fairgoer and Sephesteren as an admirer. After mingling with the folk for a few hours, they were able to inform me that Sir Ginselin was far more enamoured of hearing his own name spoken in reverent tones than he was of lands or wives. He had a small but devoted entourage of admirers around him, even some other professional jousters, who had to constantly assure him that he was, indeed, the champion he suspected he was. His desire for gold was eclipsed by his desire for fame and glory, but his youthful face and strong arm was enough to get plenty of it all. Sir Ginselin was managed by an older uncle, Sir Reselad, a canny sort, better suited for a career as a coin brother than in arms. Sir Reselad was rarely out of earshot of his young charge, and ensured he had a steady supply of whatever he fancied, as long as he kept winning. But the string of ribbons on his campaign banner demonstrated his facility with tending his skilled nephew. Tyndall and Bannermore's target was the Wenshari knight, Sire Mavoxagon, who collected estates the way a child collects pretty pebbles. He was an older knight, twice widowed, wealthy enough to spend his summers touring fairs, and a respected war leader in his own lands. He was a stern and dispassionate man for whom war and power were the only true stakes, Bannermore reported. While not technically a professional jouster, he rarely strayed from the northern circuit, whatever that was, he was a regular enough contestant that even professionals were wary of his mighty lance. Indeed, several professionals had already fallen in the previous day's bouts. Each of the top three competitors would face one of the next three competitors to begin the day, the victor in each contest to advance to fight each other, round-robin style. The victor of that contest would win the fair domain and the fairer hand of Lady Estrent. I dismissed them to eat while I thought about their reports. Just as the fried breads were served, dipped in sugar and ginger, I had a plan. All right, I decided, after that first glorious bite of fried bread. Fried breads are a guilty pleasure of mine. Growing up in a bakery, frying bread dough in oil was seen as a common peasant's attempt to cheat briggers' ovens out of their due. We ate properly baked breads, religiously. I still half expected the old man to waddle out and slap my wrist with a spoon for the temerity, which made the bread all the sweeter. Here's what I want to do. Tyndall and Bannermore, it's your turn to go to Sir Ginsulin's encampment with a message. And Festeran and Sagal, you head over to Sire Mavoxigan's, and when you get there, here's what I want you to say. They all looked at me wide-eyed and incredulous when I was done. Sir Festeran looked at me, his young face anxious. Mage Lord, are you sure? Of course he's sure, Tyndall said, shaking his head and grinning. I know what he's doing. As do I, chuckled Bannermore. They explained it to Sagal, whose mind just doesn't naturally work that way, thank goodness, and then they left on their various errands as the fair woke up around us. After I woke up my pretty wife and changed the baby, no spell to do that yet, I'm afraid, we enjoyed some more fried breads and then attended to Sir Kay, who was earnestly preparing for the bout by alternating stretching, punching the air, and praying. We watched while he was armoured and broke his fast, and I got a new appreciation of just how large a man he was. The deft way he moved with lance and sword as he warmed up belied his size, but I could tell he wasn't quite on the point of the spear yet. His eyes kept shifting away uncomfortably, or filling with doubt for but an instant. Sir Kay, I comforted him after bringing him some herbal tea. Fear not. I dispatched emissaries to the camps of the other two contenders and told them that you will make generous offers to them for Lady Estrit and this estate she loves. I have, myself, pledged to aid you in whatever way I can, as a token of what you have done in the restoration of Sevendor. Mage Lord, he began, choking up. The largest obstacle, from what I can see, is that they will not think you, a newcome country knight from the Farmindens, as serious in your negotiations, nor, as you are aware, is it seemly for a gentleman to discuss such things in the light of day. So you must walk the line between powerfully earnest and determined, but utterly laconic. If the judges think there might be a deal in the offing to fix the bout? Sir Kay looked startled. You're right, Mage Lord. No need to get disqualified. Nor would I do less than my best in the tournament, even if it meant the surety of her hand. But I take the wisdom of what you say. I shall demonstrate my earnestness, but I shall speak of nothing but the lists. Today is a day when Duin the Destroyer guides my hand, he said fiercely. They're so cute when they get like that, Alia whispered with a giggle in my ear, as Sir Kay's armourers began the process of wrapping him in steel. It wasn't an hour after I left Alia and the squires to finish armouring Kay that my messengers returned, each of them looking thoughtful and pleased with themselves. It is done, Sagal nodded, looking a little pale. Only a new-made yeoman, he was playing in social politics far above his ken, and that made him uncomfortable. That was fine. I wanted him to learn such things, as he had more sense than most and complete loyalty to me, two gifts I would not see tarnished with misuse. Sire Mavoxigan was surprised to hear of Sir Kay's dedication to the contest. He did not seem eager to consider that outcome. Sir Ginsulin went beyond surprised, Tyndall told me wryly. He was appalled. It is only a bloody contest after all, he said, and while a dedicated and devoted contestant, I understand, I nodded, smiling. He has no desire to see things get out of hand. He's far more concerned about the tournament in Funis in 2 weeks than he is about this, Sir Festeran agreed earnestly. He wanted to start sending his retinue out tonight, just to see that they get a good seating there. I sighed. That was about as much preparation as we'd get. Either this would work, or it wouldn't. All right, Tyndall, I want you to take care of Sir Kay's tack. See every strap is tight and fit, and if you use a few binding cantrips to keep them from slipping, I won't say anything to Sir Kay if you don't. Then I want you to go into the arming tents and order 3 new war lances. Not tournament lances, real sharp war lances. to be delivered to his station in the lists by noon. Festeron, I want you to take Sir Kay's sword, his war sword, not his tournament sword, into the fairgrounds to find a man to sharpen it. Pay good money. Make sure you tell plenty of people who it belongs to, but don't mention why. Sagal, you think you can play an obnoxious peasant? My brother-in-law chuckled. Of course he could. Just ask my sister-in-law. Then I want you on the opponent's end. Heckling, here's a purse. Get good and soused if you have to. Don't worry, I'll make it good with Ella. Don't violate the fair oath, but shout every little obnoxious thing you can say, as loud as you can say it, just up to the point where they chase you. Keep them on edge. Bannermore, you do the same, magically. Don't do anything to actually, technically cheat, mind you. But if a foot wizard, like yourself, can't think of 100 annoying cantrips you could use, you aren't worthy of the name. Everyone got their assignments? Then go, and we'll see just how certain we can make the outcome. Alia took extra time to dress and prepare that morning, since we would be spending the day at the lists. Darishi was in charge of the baby, and there were a few other retainers who wanted to attend in our company, including Sir Ronsel, who was betting heavily on his fellow knight, and Sir Ferrando, who had been unceremoniously knocked out in the first round. We also invited Sir Sigalan of Trestendor and his sister, Lady Sasha, to sit with us, since they had already seen the fair and were at odds for entertainment. Once I got our spectators and our agents safely underway, I helped oversee the last of Sir Kay's armouring, while Tyndall saw to his charger. "I have faced certain death and defeat," he said calmly and slowly, as he settled his gambeson on over his bare chest. "I have faced hordes of goblins and sneering outlaws, and never have I felt so anxious about a contest." It was one of those rare moments where he was looking to me for support and guidance, and I realized another burden that comes with nobility, the duty to inspire and invest your people with your confidence. "Calm yourself, Kay," I encouraged, as casually as I could. "The fortunes and the gods are with you. Just don't be distracted by the glint of the prize and fail to strike true with your lance."
"Bah! She is no prize! She is a woman. Gracious, beautiful, warm and lovely. She is only 5 years my junior, Minolin, and she has a little girl already from her first husband."
I blinked. He'd called me by name. No title. A breach of familiarity that was noteworthy. This was unexpected. When a man goes through what we've been through, it changes him. It places his life in proper perspective. Surely you understand.
"Well, certainly," I said, smiling.
"But perhaps you could be more specific," I said, helping him strap his shoulder pauldrons on. "When I was at Beauval, I was a young man, a knight with an important post and a prosperous future. In due time, when I had the means, I'd planned to begin the search for a bride within the next year. But Cherul, damn his empty eyes, intervened. I had my duty to look to then, and then I had to see the Beauvali refugees were settled, as I had pledged to do on my honour. But then seeing you and Lady Alia at your wedding, and all of the unions at Sevendor, it makes a man wonder what he might leave behind him when his body lies cold on the field." I studied him thoughtfully.
"You are one morbid son of a bitch, Kay," I observed. "That's perhaps the dullest, least romantic argument for love I've ever heard."
It didn't faze him, as I knew it wouldn't. Knights are just like that.
"You have given me far more opportunity at Sevendor than I deserve, Minolin. Far more than you should have, considering how foolishly I behaved in Beauval. But now that I have a stake at fortune, the gods have seen fit to put in my path a prize far more glorious than mere honour or duty. Mayhap they have given me a test that I might win with my arm what my heart would slay thousands for."
"She really had an effect on you," I said, shaking my head in amazement as I stuck his riding gloves into his belt. His armourers were just strapping on his greaves as Tyndall led his mount up, freshly carried and gleaming. "It is not her beauty, although that would be enough," Sir Kay said quietly. "There are fairer maidens, true. Nor is it the richness of her holding. An apiary is no mean prize, but there are wealthier widows. It is Minolin. She begged me that if it came to a choice between harming myself on the lists or pressing my case to my death, as I told her I would do, she begged that I yield, not out of fear,
but out of concern from some love she bears for me. He looked guilty at the admission.
Kay, are you sure?
I asked, a little confused. Maybe she was just giving him a line of bullshit. Lady Estret told me that, of all the combatants on the lists, it was clear that I, alone, was a worthy gentleman, the sort she would see for a father to her child, and her children to come, and that she would not have me throw away my life so senselessly in pursuit of the likes of her, a poor widow. She would prefer a loveless marriage to a tournament hero than the thought of my blood on her hands.
Oh, well, that made a little more sense, in the mad, twisted logic of femininity.
Then you have to ignore her, I advised. Of course she has to say that. She really does like you, if my wife is any judge. But do not let her plea weaken your resolve. So ignore her counsel, and do what you know must be done. You face but two opponents. Two mighty opponents, he reminded me, concerned.
Mighty? Only if you believe the jongleurs. I wouldn't be worried about Sir Mavoxigan,
Tyndall said, nonchalantly, as he held Sir Kay's steed. That bay destrier of his looks fierce, and he rides well, but his left hind shoe has been loose all day, and no one has bothered to fix it. That means he isn't getting good firm grounding on that side when he couches to charge. He'll be weak on his shield arm, and ripe to take a lance. Sir Kay nodded in understanding, considered silently if it would be chivalrous to use such intelligence, and then nodded firmly.
See? Fortune favours you already,
I soothed the big knight as I slipped his snowflake snowstone pendant over his head and helped him mount on his charger. Now, why don't you two head up to the list field to get checked in, and I'll see you in the stands. Doing strength with you today, my friend, I said, clapping him on his armoured thigh. He gave me a meaningful look before he rode off, looking just a little love-drunk and dazed. I hoped he could find his way to the lists. I hurried to pack a basket and headed up to the list field myself and found our party with no great difficulty. Alia purchased a prominent section of the stands for us and arrayed quilts and blankets on the hard pine logs to the point where they were merely uncomfortable, not tortuous. She had directed the two servants she'd brought to erect a small canopy over the baby against the sun and wind. There was also a big hamper of sweetmeats, fruits and biscuits, and another one of ales and wines and cool water she had brought from camp. Sire Sigalan and his sister were our guests, and they were already enjoying biscuits and honey with hot tea in the mid-morning sun when I arrived. "This will be the finest entertainment I've enjoyed in a while," I said, as I settled into the delightfully cushioned seat that had been prepared for me. "I just had to give Sir Kay a pep talk," I added to Sire Sigalan knowingly. "He's a bit nervous."
"As well he should be," Sigalan agreed with a smile. "He did phenomenally well on the lists yesterday. The joust is not my strength, but I have a keen enough eye to see his style is compelling."
"My brother is unjust," Lady Sasha objected. "Your castellan rolled through these summer warriors like they were children riding llamas," his sister said, less diplomatically and more enthusiastically. "I never noted how handsome Sir Kay was until I saw him throw his helmet in bloodlust after winning his second bout."
That made Sir Roncil glance sharply in her direction.
"I'm sorry I missed that," I admitted truthfully.
It was still early in the day, and the Baron wanted to ensure everyone who'd paid his entrance fee got their money's worth. We got to see roving bands of clowns and jugglers skitter gingerly around the lists, stopping periodically to cut a caper or to hurl hilarious insults at the audience. We had a bowl full of pennies at hand to reward the cleverest. Then we got to see the last three bouts of the Squires tournament, in which the unspurred contended for glory, honour, and title to a pregnant sow. While amateurish, even to my untrained eye, it was entertaining purely because of the earnest looks on the jousters' faces. The youngest among them was 14, a squire from Sashtalia, who ended up taking the day 3-2 over a hulking 16-year-old from Sendaria. We enjoyed another flight of clowns and jugglers, and then vendors purveying everything from sausages and sugar loaves to candied pears to warm ale or cold cider descended upon the stands. While they were transacting business, a troop of 10 acrobats entertained from a trestled stage. It was mid-morning, and I was having a very good time.
The weather was perfect, just a little cool, and the birds and the insects seemed to conspire to entertain us, not annoy us. Flirting lightly with Alia, playing with the baby, having someone else change the baby, getting to know the soft-spoken sire Sigilyn, and learning to appreciate his wisdom and intellect, and delighting in his sister's sharp humour. I was as relaxed and at ease as I'd been in ages. I wasn't even dwelling on the unpleasant news from Alshar I'd gotten at dawn. I felt at peace. Of course, someone would have to wander by and fuck that up.
I see Arathaniel keeps all the bandits in one place, then,
came a familiar, if unwelcome, voice. We turned around to see the scowling countenance of Sire Gimbal, the warbird of West Flaria, looming behind us. He had a small retinue of 5 or 6 knights and squires, including his elderly adviser, Sir Brummel. While his sword was tied with the peace knot, there were daggers in his eyes.
"Oh, Sire Gimbal, our benefactor," I said, immediately on alarm.
I considered sending mind to mind to Tyndall for support, but relaxed. I couldn't imagine Gimbal starting anything here, when it would be seen as both discourteous and punishable, particularly not around my child. If he did, I'd burn him to a crisp.
"Benefactor?" he asked, confused.
"Yes, we're using the proceeds from the ransoms you have so graciously paid to fund our outing," I said,
delivering the insult pleasantly. I didn't need to even pretend to like the man. Alia stared daggers right back at him, sharper, more feminine daggers. Sire Sigilyn and his sister just held their breath.
"Do feel free to send even more mercenaries to our frontiers. I have so many new constructions to fund."
"Using magic and treachery against honest warriors is no way to fight," the warbird growled.
"Harassing honest peasants on their way to market is not either," I said. "But I am new to the chivalry. Perhaps I've been misinformed."
"You speak to me of chivalry. I know not what goes on beyond that sorcerous wall of yours,"
Sire Gimbal grumbled, leaning on the rail. "But the lights and portents, the peasants all whisper of your abominations. It is evil at work, and all the Bontal knows it."
"It's magic at work, you ignorant lout," Lady Alia said sassily.
"When your folk need more daylight to plough, you beat them and find them. When our folk need a few extra hours of light to tend the fields, we provide it for them."
"It is unnatural," he protested.
"That's the point," I stressed.
"Sevendor is a mage land now. We do things differently there. Magic is our servant, from Lord to Valaine, and all prosper accordingly. Thus it should be throughout the mage lands in the future."
"Bah! It is illegal and an abomination," countered Sir Brummel. "The gods weep at the sight. The lords of our realm will never stand for it."
"If they don't, then the lords of the realm are going to be short, black, and furry," I riposted. "You cannot fight against the dead god without us. Or do you think you have the eggs to slay a dragon, warbird?" That made Gimbal go pale a bit. By now, everyone had heard about the Day of the Dragons in Gilmora.
"Regardless, it is an insult to our noble ancestors that upstarts like you, a baker's son, a peasant mage, a spellmonger, that you should rule on our borders. It will not be endured, not while I draw breath. Mark my son's faith, will you? Steal my lands, will you? You shall learn what it is to challenge the proper order of things. There are traditions in the Riverlands, and one does not attack those traditions lightly."
"Like the tradition of your brother and you, cowardly attacking Baron Arathaniel's kin in creating your West Flaria?"
asked Lady Sasha acidly.
"Like the tradition of taking secret counsel with the Lord of Sashtalia and depriving the rightful lords of Trestendor their holdings, burning villages, slaying peasants, bullying merchants? Is that the noble Riverlands tradition you uphold, warbird?"
Sigilyn's sister was bold. Far more bold than I'd usually seen a noblewoman be in such discussions.
"As the lady has mentioned, things change," I observed. "A noble house can be beset by upstarts, and a thieving warlord can be challenged by the good and righteous, just like in the epics."
The gods would have had to choose that time to send us a mama's show. Not just any show, a merry gang of professional buffoons, which included a number of dwarfs, and freakish-looking folk, tumbled into the list in front of us, pantomiming a spoof. About me, apparently. The shortest of the midgets wore a spellmonger's cap and an overlong mantle that dragged the ground several feet behind him. He capered along until his way was blocked by five ugly-looking men in checkered cloaks. The cloaks were mere sackcloth, hastily painted with black squares, and the wands of the ersatz censers were a comic variety of sausages, axe handles, feather dusters, and knitting needles. The censers surrounded the poor dwarf until he seemed overwhelmed. Then a comically heroic second midget appeared, bounding in a somersault over the censers, wielding a long loaf of bread. While the mage knight dueled sausage to bread with one, the spellmonger reached into his pants with great exaggeration and withdrew a large, bright green ball, and then another. In a delightful show of juggling and acrobatics, the two pelted the checkered-cloaked censers into the ground. Then, at a silent command, they all stood stock still, while the overly officious, yet clearly benevolent, baron appeared to take the censers away. The mage knight broke his loaf and flung it into the crowd, and the spellmonger threw candy to the laughing children.
"Well done!"
my wife screamed, applauding with the rest of our group, and throwing a fistful of pennies. Sure, it had been a blatant pander to us, but it had been genuinely witty, and it told me something more important. "See, Warbird," I said, gesturing at the mummers. "The people certainly know which side is in their interest. In Sundaria, perhaps, under the Baron's thumb," he observed coolly. "They'd sing a different tune in Westphalia. We don't forget insults there, nor do we forgive them. Sir Gimble, I've never sought a quarrel with you, but you seem to crave one. Whether I'd enjoy your enmity or not, it departs the road of wisdom for you to seek one with me. I am powerful, and not merely in magic. I have powerful friends, dukes among them. Yet you persist, for no better reason, I can see, than your guilt and your blemished honour. You harass my folk on the road, and charge a ransom for passage. You send spies and raiders into my frontier, and yet every effort you expend against me comes to naught. Why, then, would you persist in this feud? You, sir, touched my honour," he said angrily. "You spit in the face of the established order and invite abomination into the Riverlands. You are an up-jumped tradesman, a paper noble, and no knight worthy of the name. Don't forget that he kept you from adding Sevendor to your clutch of destitute domains," Sigilyn's sister added bravely. "And without Sevendor safely in pocket, you may not turn your attentions to other prey. The brayings of the rustic nobility have little part in the greater matters of politics," Sir Brummel said condescendingly. "Neither does plain truth, it seems," she added haughtily, and sipped her cider. "It is good you have found such fast friends in the Riverlands, Sire Sigilyn," Sir Brummel continued obsequiously. "Baron Arathaniel is a weighty name to have as a friend, but if you are not allegianced, well, 'tis but a name. When has he fought in the name of friendship? Or perhaps, then, the good mage lord will ride to your aid when next you are beset by bandits or raiders?" The thuggish threat was clear. "And how many lances will Sevendor bring to your aid?" howled one of the other knights in the retinue. "Less than a dozen, if we figure correctly, and the rest a peasant's rabble." That touched my honour. I stood and surveyed Gimble's lackey, a thin young man with the worst moustache I'd ever seen clinging to his lip. "A dozen lances. Sevendor needs but one, and while you're counting noses and swords, neither of which I'd trust you to figure beyond a score without removing your trousers, you should concern yourself less with lances and more with bows." "Bows?" he asked, confused. My lady wife saw her chance to get a dig in the name of national pride. "Aye, the famous Wilderlands bows my peasant folk carry. They shoot half again as far as your Riverlands toys. They fly 3-foot laminate arrows with a 6-inch steel bodkin point, and they can go through armour like parchment within 50 feet. All our Bovar lads used them against the wolves of the Minden since they were old enough to walk. Cowherds killing wolves are hardly warriors,"
scoffed another West Flarian lord. "Against Riverland knights!
And every lad in Sevendor, who survived the siege of Beauval Vale, has loosed 1,000 arrows into the throats of goblins who were screaming for their blood day and night. Our youths have seen more blood spilled in a year than your dotards in their lives."
She recited the gory history evenly, but she said it proudly, without hesitation, and with supreme confidence. She wasn't the Lady of Sevendor, politely trading jibes with the nobility. She was Alia of Hawk's Reach, daughter of the Minden Vales, beating back the edge of the wilderness to reveal the steely warrior within. Seeing my saucy lady back this insolent knight up into the stands was a treat, and I loved her the more dearly for it. Still, Gimbal's lackey was not intimidated. "Bows," he sneered dismissively, "in the hands of peasants."
"And wands," I countered, "drawing one, in the hands of knights magi. You wish to assail Sevendor in earnest? I invite you to try, and add this to your calculations. Allies? Few, but loyal. Lances? We have enough. Arrows? We have a sufficiency. Magi? We have a plethora. And defiance in the face of injustice? Gentlemen, Sevendor holds that in abundance," I lectured, addressing the warbird directly. "Continue this antipathy at your peril. It shall not profit West Flaria, or any of her allies or liegemen, to press this toward war." There, I'd said it. War. I watched Gimbal's nostrils flare at the challenge, and he could no longer evade or prevaricate what he and his men were doing to our frontiers. "War?" he asked quietly. "You know little of war, spellmonger. There is a difference between slaughtering goblins and facing a real warrior on a real battlefield. My family is known for their perseverance at the art, and for 5 generations we have enjoyed a reputation for bloodshed and victory. A legacy that you and your peasant wench may feel the weight of all too dearly." I shrugged. "My family has a reputation for the best holiday breads in the Riverlands. That doesn't make me a baker. And if I were you," I said with an insulting guffaw, "I'd quit holding your family's great gift of warfare up as an example until you have an heir who can manage to hold on to his fief." I turned and went to sit down without addressing him again. It was only then that I heard someone yelling, "Fair peace! No, my lord, you have sworn the oath!" And I turned to see Gimbal's men physically restraining him, holding his hand away from his peace-knotted sword hilt. They dragged him away quickly, before the fair wardens took notice of the commotion. "Pray ignore them," Sire Sigilan counseled me quietly, as he poured me a glass of the sweet mountain wine his people made. "Gimbal is searching for a stronger cause to stir up trouble. He has been for years. In all his machinations, he never suspected he'd have a strong foe suddenly on an unguarded border. My lady Alia, were you serious about your bowmen?" he asked skeptically. "The Bovali are good archers, well used to sniping at wolves, goblins, lazy wilderlands, lions, and other common pests of the Mindens," she answered, "and their range is not in doubt. I have seen a wolf slain across 400 yards of Valley Meadow."
"And Sire Gimbal has done little enough to make them feel welcome in the Riverlands,"
Sir Ronsel added.
"Should you ask my folk to march on West Flaria, you'd have to limit the volunteers."
"You aren't worried about a war with West Flaria?" he asked, surprised.
"Of more concern is the war with Sherul, the dead god," I pointed out. "He is a gaping wound in my chest. Gimbal is an annoying rock in my boot." That seemed to satisfy my new friend, and we spent the next hour or so bantering gaily while we watched the jousting and drank. All too soon I felt a contact mind to mind. It was Tyndall, who had wandered off during the Squire's tournament, thankfully. I could just imagine what he would have added to the tense discussion.
"Yeah? Master, I was wondering if you wanted to place a wager before the bout," he asked. "Festeran and I are going to, and Bannermore already did. I know you did well yesterday. Would you like to bet on Kay's opponent this time?" he teased.
"Put 50 ounces of gold on Sir Kay to win first prize," I ordered him.
"Wait, have they given fresh odds?"
I waited a moment while he checked.
"Aye, master. Believe it or not, they are up from yesterday. 28-1, he places first. 11-1, he places second.
Some of Oxygen is the favourite. Not as good as yesterday, but still a healthy return. Put 100 ounces of gold on K. To win.
Master?
Do it, I ordered. Send someone for my seal, if you need to. But coin brother Abros should remember me from yesterday. I put wagering and other inconsequential matters out of mind, and studied the list as the first of the three bouts began between Sir Mavoxigan and Sir Jinsalan. While not the expected end to the tournament, the two were well-respected professionals who had met on the Northern Circuit more than once, according to Lady Sasha. They conducted themselves as such, despite the small fortune at stake. At this stage of the competition, they had already covered their costs, so the ultimate victory, while coveted, was not essential. After far too much fanfare, the two gentlemen broke a lance apiece against each other's shields, whirled prettily to the applause of the crowd, and returned to their side. As he passed, however, Sir Mavoxigan tarried a moment in front of us, no doubt seeing the crude Sevendor banner dangling from our canopy. "My lord," he called respectfully, "I see you sponsor Sir Kay of Beauval." "Sir Kay of Sevendor," I corrected, "but I have that honour." The warrior considered. "If I could beg the boon of your opinion, my lord, do you know him as a man to make rash statements, or prone to hyperbole?" "I have never seen Sir Kay speak aught but truthfully," I assured him. "I have known him since I was a girl, and if he has spoken any untrue word, he has not the knowledge of it," added Alia, who was more than half drunk. Sir Mavoxigan considered again, and then saluted smartly. "My thanks for your polite response, gentlefolk," he said smoothly. "Pray enjoy the combat." He spurred his bay destrier into position, and had a fresh lance handed to him by an attendant. After testing it to his satisfaction, he slapped down his face guard and proceeded to drive Sir Jinsalan off his horse by shattering a lance on the left side of his helmet. Regardless of the outcome, Sir Mavoxigan had secured second place with that strike. Sir Jinsalan had secured a rapidly spreading bruise, even through his formerly pretty helmet. But Tyndall had not been mistaken. The bay's rear left shoe was loose. "He is going to be a tough one for Sir Kay to master," murmured Sire Sigalan, scratching his patchy chin thoughtfully. "Jinsalan will be the easier contest, particularly after that last blow. Indeed, the young knight had to send for a new helm, and called quarter to refresh himself and collect his wits. Sir Kay was led to some of Oxygen's spot on his charger, his plain armour and unsophisticated arms, painted across his broad, rawhide-faced shield, seemed almost glaringly common among the colourful pageantry of the event. If he felt distracted by the banners, and shouting, and colours, it did not show in Sir Kay's eyes. They were fixed at the far end of the list, where Sir Jinsalan was remounting and rearming. That first tilt was wild, as Jinsalan's big chestnut destrier seemed reluctant, while Sir Kay's charger eagerly thundered down the field. Sir Kay's simple barrel helmet slid forward, challenging the lance. His huge war shield, he held nearly flat against him, canted ever so slightly. His beefy paw gripped the lance as if it grew from his palm, and the blunted tip never seemed to waver at all, once he couched it, without the aid of a rest. Sir Kay was resolution in human form, galloping against a knight of stoves like a thunderbolt. Sir Jinsalan panicked at the last second, throwing his courtesy shield too wide, actually deflecting Sir Kay's well-thrust lance up into his own faceplate, where it caught. There was an exaggerated explosion of wood upon steel, and while the blow did not send the knight fully into the dirt, as it had Sir Ewan the day before, it did leave him dragging by one stirrup from his destrier along the list field in a most undignified manner. Sir Jinsalan, or his uncle, if you wanted to be technical, yielded the bout to Sir Kay, and graciously accepted third place, which was enough, I hoped, to at least buy him a new helmet. That was the second he'd ruined in a day. Sir Kay looked surprised at the victory, but was still feeling his blood run high as Sir Mavoxigan was led into place as his next challenger. Sir Mavoxigan waited until Sir Kay was grasping the lance, when he signalled the herald with a reversed lance. He ceded the entire match. Sir Kay looked around in surprise and stunned disbelief as the crowd went wild, and the heralds made the appropriate marks on the display board indicating his victory.
Grooms led his horse to the centre of the lists, in front of the reviewing stand, to claim his lords. Baron Arathaniel waited there with several of his guests, including the beaming Lady Estrid of Carguenyon. Sir Kay removed his unscratched helmet and managed a very decent salute with his lance as his charger's mane was decorated with a wreath of roses. The Baron came forth, pronounced the results to the cheering crowd, beaming broadly. This had been the most dramatic contest at the lists in recent history. He congratulated my knight, presented him with the gold-painted rod that betokened his victory, and then presented him with his new bride. Sir Kay did himself no dishonour when he deftly flung a surprised and delighted Lady Estrid into the saddle in front of him, and then tore around the list field, waving to the screaming and cheering crowds of all of Sandaria. "What was all that about wondering if Sir Kay was a man of his word?" Alia asked me in between cheers and a few happy tears. "That? Oh, remember when I told you I'd send an emissary to each camp to suggest Sir Kay would be willing to negotiate with the victor for the hand of Lady Estrid, should he not prevail?"
"Yes. Did you bribe them, then?"
she asked in disbelief. "That would have been dishonourable," I chided, unworthy of a mage lord and a member of the chivalry. "No. I had each of our messengers report to Sir Kay's opponents that he wasn't so much intent to purchase the hand of Lady Estrid as much as fight to the death for it."
"What?"
she shrieked. "I just figured it would be cheaper," I reasoned. "I figured Sir Jinsalan wouldn't know what a sharp blade is, as good at the joust as he might be. The idea of Sir Kay coming after him with a naked sword and anger in his eyes would make him soil himself. When he heard that Sir Kay was actually having his sword sharpened and three fresh war lances delivered to the list field, I'd wager he nearly did."
"But what about Sir Mavoxigan?"
she asked, puzzled. "He doesn't look the type to back down so easily from a fight."
"No,"
I agreed. "Sir Mavoxigan was a professional jouster, but he was also an honest warrior with significant holdings west of Sandaria. He wouldn't back down from a fight. But he wouldn't look for a fight he didn't have to or couldn't win. He had a firm grip on second place, and he weighed the price of a chance at injury in a second-string fair tournament at the beginning of the season against the value of assuring second place, a whole skin, and an early start toward the next tourney. It was a good business decision," I pointed out. "He made double what he paid to enter, plus token ransoms, and he did all right in the wagering, if I judge him properly."
"So, what was all that?"
"Oh, he had certainly heard about the rumour. I made sure he'd heard that Sir Kay would challenge the victor to a mortal duel. That's what he was thinking about when he asked if Sir Kay was a man prone to wild exaggeration. I earnestly said no. And so did you," I reminded her.
"But I thought he was talking about negotiating for Lady Estrid," she said,
finally understanding. "And he thought I was talking about Sir Kay threatening to go on an impassioned rampage. So when we said yes, we were telling him that he was willing to fight, even while I thought we were telling him we were willing to deal." "It was cheaper," I reminded her, "and I made a killing in wagering, enough for a handsome gift to the bride and groom." "Just look at them," I said, cheering as they made their second lap around the list, spring flowers falling around them from the crowd. "That's the happiest I've ever seen Sir Kay." With his future wife sitting side-saddle in front of him, he only looked bigger and more imposing on his charger. But that goofy grin softened the effect.
"You are the most devious man I've ever met, Minilan the Spellmonger,"
my lady wife accused. "First you remake Sevendor, then you reconstitute my people, and now you have found a mate for our stalwart knight.
Oh, just look how happy they are,"
she squealed as they galloped by on their third lap of the lists. The baby joined her just to be part of the excitement. "Yes. Look at him smile," I nodded, unable to contain my own. "He won his bride and his fief, and now he's going to be a proper lord in a proper marriage. The poor bastard doesn't have a clue what's about to happen to him."